some of them part of the needlework industry.
And did they stay?
Well, one stayed until she was married, and the other one stayed for a great many years until... I can't remember if she stayed until she retired or until she went out and did something else. I think she stayed until she retired. Mm-hmm. Well, no, she went into the office. She left the fieldwork and became a bar clerk in the office. She found the fieldwork too demanding, and she wanted some home ties. She wanted to have a bird in a cage in her own armchair.
It seemed like it was really a very deep and loyal commitment that many of you made to the Bureau who came in early.
Oh, you didn't think of it a commitment. It was a job. But as I look back on it, yes, it was in many ways a stupid job because you just didn't have any ties. Unless you had friends in the community, you were very often as the years went on. And of course, we're a mobile country, so I always had friends in California, quite a few, but I was never at a loss there, and I was never at a loss in Chicago because I had friends there. But if you didn't, why, you were on your own. Yeah.
What was the relationship like in the office itself? Between Miss Anderson and the other women who were working in the office, for instance, or between they and the field workers? Was it a...
Oh, very frankly, yes. In those days, jobs weren't so well delineated. If you came in and had anything to do, I'd wonder, and say, Doe, what can I do for you? If I had a few days, or maybe someone in the publicity division needed somebody to help write something for a few days. If you didn't have something you were doing, we shifted around. It wasn't...
That was
in the early days. Later it got... People had their jobs.
When did that shift happen, do you think?
Oh, I don't know, just gradually.
Was it still under Miss Anderson, or was it when Fred Miller came in?
Well, more after, I should say, then. But, of course, times were changing, too. I wouldn't say it was entirely the personality. It was I think there were many people who were very devoted to Miss Anderson. There was a very strong loyalty. She was not a person, with any academic background, but a lot of common sense to the very end. I talked to her the day before she died, and she still, one of the field agents was coming to visit me, and it was after I was living here, and I said, we came over the next day, and she said, well, what time are you coming? And I said, well, it depends on Becky Small, she's very active in the YW at that time as general president for the Philadelphia area and on the National Board and so on. I said, depends on her commitments. Oh, well, she said, how stupid of me to ask. She said, of course, I'll be right here. She said, I'm not going anywhere. She was dead the next day. Mm-hmm.
Was the relationship between she and Princess, someone like yourself, on a fairly egalitarian basis, or was there a clear hierarchy in the organization?
No hierarchy in those days.
Do you think she ever felt inadequate because she was not as formally educated as many of the people who were working in the Bureau?
Yes and no. I mean, she had very good common sense. I think she'd admit her lacks of things, but I don't think she felt inadequate. She felt she had something else to offer, and some of the most academic people were the most devoted to her,
mm-hmm.
because they recognized her common sense and her. I remember at a meeting with lots of men one time that was during the war, and I was going out to work on something. So she said, "Well, come along and listen in on this meeting." That's all. We've been there a while. And she spoke up and she said, gentlemen, what did we come to talk about? We haven't got there yet. We've been here more than a half an hour. And a man who was head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out and he said, oh, thank God, Mary, somebody's got some common sense. I was sitting there just wondering how I was going to have this. They were just, floating all around talking about everything. And she just thunders out, what did we come to talk about? And it brought the meeting. It just been quite a bit. She had a certain common sense, which I'm sure you don't get academically.
So there was really common respect on both sides.
Yes, I think people, Louise Stitt, who was very academic, who died last year, had taught at the University of Ohio, was one of her most devoted workers.
When do you think the shift did begin to occur before Freda Miller came in?
Oh, well, I don't know. You can't pinpoint a trend. We had so many trends, things just changed.
Yeah, it was a gradual change.
I think gradual change in our attitudes.
In what way?
I think we're probably less concerned. Don't you think we've gone more and more? I think our young today are, not all of them, but the vast majority are concerned only about me.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an improvement, don't you?
So in terms of the commitment to social reform
and so on, is today, what can I get out of it? What is it? They're not too interested in community things.
Yeah.
Some of them, always some, but, well, maybe there was disillusion as time went on, too. You saw the things that you thought could be done just weren't being done.
So among those who
thought your remedies just didn't work. We know that still goes on.
So those who were old-timers perhaps were disillusioned at the same time new people coming in
didn't have quite the same illusions of the idealism. I think those, don't you? Those are sort of interacting.
Yeah, it certainly seems to me like there's a qualitative difference between the commitment of the women in the 1920s and even
I think there is very much the New Deal.
Uh-huh. And then you get, because you did have that whole social work tradition and all of the linkages between all those groups in those early days.
Yes, I think it probably was a little bit, nobody would admit it, but not exactly the do-gooder, but it was, you thought you were doing something anyway, or that you might be doing something that had some effect. Well, as time went on, you felt less and less of that.
Mm.
Was it worthwhile?
Do you think that was true of many of the old-timers in the Bureau began to feel that way?
Well, many of those were gone by that time.
Mm. Oh, by the time it shifted?
Yes, some of those things. Miss Manning was gone, Mrs. Best, Miss Winslow, a lot of them that were in there still were some, but...
How many of you were there that...
Oh, I don't know. They were...
Continued on through, say, up through the war years. There was you and Mary Elizabeth were you in there?
Yes, and Caroline Manning was there until, I think, in the early 40s, and Carrie Graves, and... There were quite a few people in the office, Doe Spring, research people, Ethel Gordon, who's died, and Mildred Gordon. She wasn't there, but she was still interested on the outside, and Mary Robinson. Well, she left in about, she was there until after the war, through the war, after Miss Miller came. I don't think after the war, I think the feeling gradually, maybe there's a change. Mm. After the war, too, of new interests and new concepts. Mm.
Because it seems like certainly with the study of the post-war plans of the women production workers seemed like such a major, major study. And I have the sense in going through just file after file there.
Well, I always wondered how much it really showed.
How much the work showed?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I think it's
right.
Incredible study.
It's so long since I've looked at it. Mm.
What I'm interested in doing is basically a follow-up in the sense of now interviewing women who were war production workers and finding out what in fact their experiences were and how it affected the rest of their lives as really kind of a longitudinal follow-up to that study. But there seemed to be I have the sense with that study that it did reveal the same kind of maybe not the same kind of idealism, but the same kind of very basic commitment to women, feeling that when demobilization came, the women were, as usual, going to get the short end of things.
Yeah, well, of course, many of the industries closed. The jobs just disappeared. They weren't there any longer. Aircraft cut off people. Your ammunition industries, they were over. And a lot of the small parts and things that they were making for shipment overseas just ceased. It wasn't the case. There weren't the opportunities. Industries went back to making what they had made all during the war, but that became their basic product with some extension. And of course, they tended to take on the kind of people they had before. Probably a few more women came in, but...
But I get the sense that the study itself was motivated by a very similar concern to that earlier concern.
Concern, yes. And,
there seems to be different quality to it what you find in, say, the late 30s and then afterwards in the 40s. Do you think that's true, that there was kind of commitment shown in that study again?
I don't know. There were a lot of field agents used on that, and some of them just, we used to think, running wild, but they weren't, because it was almost entirely an interview study, wasn't it?
And, right. And what was interesting...
There were no controls that you were working against.
No, it was 13,000 interviews with the production workers.
Yes.
And there was no, unfortunately, there was no follow-up.
Didn't they do other than production workers?
I'm sorry, yes, they did.
It was more on an industrial basis.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that I guess what I feel is a different quality to it is it reminded me of some of the earlier studies where there was almost an advocacy position taken.
Yes.
Although they couldn't do it outright, but between the lines.
And probably we got less and less because, after all, they were more critical when it passed for review upstairs that we weren't to take any definite. We could state the facts,
uh-huh.
And then people were to make their own deductions.
Well, and I think in that case...
Of course, you could do. We did. I mean, you always stretch them a little bit. You always pointed up the things you wanted to point up that were bad. But basically, you didn't come out to advocate anything.
Mm-hmm.
You,
well, I think maybe in that study, because it's based solely on interviews, that probably an advocacy position came through.
And of course, that's one of the hardest things to tabulate because it's there's so many fringe edges.
Were you involved in that?
No, I was in the. I don't think I was working on a telephone survey and some other things. And we made the telephone union wanted us to make a survey, so we did quite an extensive. There were four or five of us on that for about a year, visiting telephone exchanges and interviewing telephone workers. It was the women in the telephone union that felt they were. Then I was working on equal pay some of that time, and special problems that came up on that. Then I worked on an absenteeism study. I was working on some that were a little more involved with industry, and Mary Hilton and I were very interested in the study in absenteeism, which was never published because it didn't show very, I just want to talk about it, didn't show what Miss Miller would have liked to have it show. I mean, it wasn't quite that, but
yeah.
It didn't show women in a very good light.
Oh, did this happen very often?
I think it happens still.
No, and then the study would not be...
Oh, no, the study not published, no. That didn't happen very often, but it was a time when women were beginning to struggle for equal pay and so on. Women's rates of absenteeism are much higher than men's.
Oh, really? Because almost all the figures always show that...
Not if they're carefully gathered.
What industries were those?
Oh, we did them in manufacturing, in insurance, in department stores, about four or five different industries. And Mary Hilton and I were very interested in it. It showed a constant pattern. Some plant might have a reduction of absentee throughout, but women tended to have just about twice as much as men. Not when you have catastrophic, but so women, somebody's sick, the wife stays home, the child's sick, and I soon gave up taking illness as a reason, because if I hadn't, we had the illest group in the world. Women, you'd have just wondered how they ever got to work, because they call in sick.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew that was what they were doing, so you just didn't. You couldn't use that as a reason. It might be the child was sick, or the husband was sick, or they had to take the dog to the vet, or they had to go down to... There were all sorts of reasons for it, but nevertheless, and many more absences, the frequency, and that's very disturbing to an employer. You can't depend on somebody. If you're sick for 6 months, or 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, well, you sort of prepare for it. But it's somebody who doesn't show up the next day, and there was a lot of that on the part of the women. They didn't have the Monday drunks that you had among young men. In the very young group, I don't think there was as much difference because it was high for both men and women. And then in the group with the women at home and children, it was pretty high, or you could correlate the two. Then as the women got older, it was much less.
How, because this does really reveal the extent to which the Bureau was a woman's advocate.
Well, yes, this was a pilot, in a sense, a pilot survey. We didn't do it extensively. It was to get some trends and to find out what the picture was. And I did enough to do
to know what,
that, and know what it was. And,
now, how was the decision made then to not proceed because it would show women in a bad light? Was that made in...
Well, maybe that it wasn't. Maybe it wasn't extensive enough. Maybe we should have made more. But you felt as a pilot survey, and the findings tended to be quite uniform.
But the decision would be made not to proceed because it would show that.
Well, it wasn't being played up too much anyway. And, if you came out, so by that time the media and so on pick it up, you would get somebody just picking it up again, taking facts out of context. Because when you analyze it right through again by groups, you might find quite different things. That not as much difference between the young men and women, more difference in that middle age group or in the industry, and very much less. And in catastrophic illness, where people are out for long periods, practically no difference. But it was this troublesome frequency of absence, and I'm sure it's true today.
Mm-hmm. Now, how would the decision be made Rizzo, for instance, would it be made informally by the researcher?
The director.
Not continue, or Miss Anderson would
then? Well, she was long after Miss Anderson's
day.
And Miss Miller's, and I don't know who's, I think it was in her day, I don't know that.
So it'd be in the, maybe late 40s?
Yes. Because Mary Hilton and I worked closely on that. She was in doing, and she was very interested, so we more or less pulled the bags. She probably wouldn't mention it. She's forgotten it.
Well, I told her that I thought someone should interview her, too. I mean, she's her commitment to the Bureau over these years has been...
Yes, so it is.
She's really, I think, has a very...
She's very, very stabilizing. She's a very good person.
About the role of the
and
Bureau.
A stabilizing and very... and has the background and the knowledge. I think she's done probably more for it than anyone else. I think she should have been the director.
Now, well, of course, the director is a political appointment always, so it seems like the directors come and go, and she just stays and holds it together. What kind of differences were there in leadership style between Miss Anderson and then Miss Miller when she came in?
Oh, I don't know that I could appraise it. It was Miss Miller came from New York, where she had a job as head of the, I believe she was in charge of the Labor Department, wasn't she director of labor for a while in New York?
I think she was
labor commissioner at the end. And she went, they were just different personalities. How
did they run the operation differently?
I suppose some of it was bias on our part, too. We liked the way Miss Anderson and Ryan probably were ready to criticize the way she was doing it. We felt there was very little favoritism with Miss Anderson. She brought her group down from New York. Quite a few people, and she brought in new people, and they didn't always know too much. I mean, they probably were very intelligent and all of that, but it was a field, a very limited field, and of course there'd be some resentment, naturally.
Well,
again, if you were in the field, you weren't as closely, you didn't buck your head against it as much as the people in the office.
The people who were in the office?
Office, yes. And,
did any of these new people go out in the field then, or most of them were brought into the office?
No, I don't think they did. By that time, they discovered field work was sort of an nasty job. just a grinding job.
Oh.
No glamour, very little glamour.
Because one of the things I noticed, and I don't know if it seems more like an accident of time, records, but I thought it might reflect some differences in kind of style of leadership.
Yes.
Is a lot of directives and memos that Miss Miller would be sending to other
people. Miss Anderson would telephone you.
Or informally meet with you.
Or wander down to see you.
Uh-huh.
She wasn't above just walking down the hall and popping in and sitting down. I mean, there wasn't all this formality. We weren't filling the files with so much.
And what do you think part of that was just a...
Well, maybe that was growing a trend. Files were getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and everybody wanted to be on record. And wanted to be protected if they did anything wrong. And I guess we didn't think so much about that.
It
was more direct communication.
Those early days, up to the war, certainly, seemed to be a much more informal...
as far as procedures, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that the research was not at all sloppy.
And probably just as effective because it was direct. You didn't have somebody dictate a letter to somebody else to dictate a letter to tell you to turn around and go the other direction. You probably just got a letter saying, we think it'd be better if you did this.
Did you have a sense from other friends in civil service that this would happen, that the same trend was happening in their jobs too, or does it?
Oh, well, of course, the Bureau was so small, and I never thought it was typical, in the early days, 50 or 60 people. That's a small clerical staff, and that included professional and everything you had. So we were much more of a unit. There wasn't as much of a feeling of... you had to maintain your job, at least in those days. Maybe that became more so true later.
I meant to ask you something about in those earlier days that I thought of it when you were talking about the beauty shop study. A woman that was interviewed by someone else, I didn't do the interview, who was basically a Communist Party trade union organizer, at one point was organizing beauty shop operators in New York. I was wondering very often especially with the dual unions in the late 20s, were there conflicts with the Bureau ever between those unions and the Bureau?
I don't think the beauty shop had ever amounted to anything because they were not the kind of people you could organize, you know. Well, They're less so now, they're probably more standardized. But in that time, there were girls who'd taken courses. Some of them had little shops in their homes, things. And they were very independent. They wouldn't have belonged to a union. They didn't care that there wasn't a payroll if they got paid every day. If they'd done five permanents and they got half the price, why? That's all they wanted, to take the money off with them when they went home.
Mm.
And there were lots of them like that in those days that just didn't even keep. It was just, it was before the wage and hour law went into effect, and before you had the unemployment compensation and all those things. So if you didn't have a payroll, why? And the state hadn't set up any regulation as to hours, and I don't think the hours were a big problem, maybe occasionally, but not because they, so it was a very disorganized industry at the beginning. Now it's become something quite different.
Yeah.
A big chains, and all the department stores are probably chain operations or concessions.
Mm.
There were a few even then at that time coming, but because that was about the only place we got. Oh, yeah, you always got people that are meticulous and keep good records, but in the beauty shop industry, you had just as many who just, a girl started bringing in her friends, and suddenly there were a whole group of them working. It was too well organized. But that's all over now, I'm sure there's nothing like that. And there were the black ones. I remember when Gracie came home and says, now you're going to learn about straightening hair, too. That is odd. And they were practically all little concessions. They were even more disorganized than the white ones.
Mm. Mm.
But,
how long did you remain a field worker, then?
Oh, more or less. I was on call for field work. There was less and less the last few years.
Oh, so you then went mainly work in the office? And
Worked on some tail end of field surveyor, helped out the person who was working in labor legislation. And letters that came in that affected field things I'd get to answer and so on. And I just decided I'd get out.
Mm.
Quit. I could have worked longer, but I was getting tired of it. There weren't the demands for field work that they'd been. We had short trips, but we didn't make studies.
Mm.
You'd go out on a spot investigation that take a week or a few days or something to.
So really, after the war, particularly, both the nature of the structure of the Bureau itself as well as the kind of studies.
Well, it continued on probably into the 50s, through the war, and well into the 50s, and then I think there was a falling off. Miss Miller left and Mrs. Leopold came. She was very amiable. I don't know how much.
Did she come on the National Consumers League?
She came after Miss Miller.
And was her background from the National Consumers League?
No. She was a clubwoman in Connecticut.
Mm.
She'd been, I believe, in the state legislature. Very affable, but really no. She was a pure political appointment. And pleasant to be with, but thought it was.
So actually, it was just Miss Anderson.
She's in a retirement home here in the area now.
Mm-hmm. So though, after that, then the directorship really did become political appointments.
More so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It was never. I don't suppose Miss Miller was even too political, because I think Miss Anderson was even consulted on Miss Miller's appointment.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
She thought Freddie Miller would be a good person. She'd known her, but then Mrs. Leopold was purely political and. And then on, I think it's always been political.
When did you actually retire then?
Oh, I did at 57. Mm-hmm. I'd had enough.
And then that's when you finally got your own apartment?
Well, no, I had one before that. I had this one before that.
Oh.
Because I was here more, and I wanted to be down in the downtown area. This was available, and I thought I'd stay here for a couple of years till after I'd retired, and then I'd go somewhere else. This is a co-op.
Oh.
And it's worked as a co-op. It's worked quite well. There are only 39 families.
How long has it worked as a co-op?
Well, it's one of the three. It was built as a co-op. And then during the 30s, I think it was built in the late, about the First World War era. And the first who began to go off. So it went out of being, it went into private ownership for, a period of 10 years or 15 years, and it became a co-op again. And they're dead now, but there were a few people who lived through both co-ops.
Oh, that's right.
They lived here as the first co-op through the rental period, back into when it became co-op. I think there were just two families there, both dead and gone now. But they were here when I came, because I was walking down the street with one man, and I said something. He said, oh, we were here through the first co-op. That was the first time I'd known. I said, what? He said, then we rented, we sold our apartment, and we bought it back.
That's interesting that we have such a long tradition.
Yes, and on the whole, it's worked very well.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like you've done a lot of traveling since you retired.
That was before.
Oh.
After I got cats, I couldn't travel.
Oh.
My cats, both of them have been relics of the co-op. Our first, the woman who was, and her husband who did our maintenance work when I first came, had a cat they were very fond of. She died, and he wasn't too responsive, so I inherited a cat. I started feeding her, feeding him. They lived with me for 10 years.
Oh.
And then this little cat was abandoned by when she was a kitten.
Oh.
Didn't want her, and he asked me to keep her. He's on the top, I think, already. He was my first.
He's a big cat.
He was my first. I don't think Greta ranked on that. That was before her day. And then she was about to be abandoned, so I took her in for a week, and she stayed for 10 years.
So most of your traveling was while you were still working then, because you gathered so much stuff from what appears to me to be traveling.
No, a little bit. Yes, I did. No, I did. I traveled a good deal while I was working. Took long leave periods.
You had a life of a lot of travel, actually.
Yes, she said, and I've had you for 10 and a half years. Yes.
Yeah.
She's known as the Duchess, the spoiled baby. Did you get to a home where you were spoiled? Are you spoiled? She says, you answer, and says, yes.
Is there anything else about the Bureau that you think might be helpful, Ethel, that I haven't asked you?
Oh, I don't. It's so hot, I haven't thought too much. I suppose I do think there was a strong core feeling in the early days, and that I think you've been quite aware of. And frankly, I wondered in recent years whether it should go on. I don't know what its function is anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I've done more and more studies of just jobs. We did some of that. We did opportunities in various industries.
Mm-hmm.
And women's utter mobility, I don't know how much you can do with that. And of course, they haven't done any wage surveys and that type of thing, or thing of the past. Maybe they should be, of course, wages and hours, and there should be a changing, but I...
Perhaps if they went back to some of the kind of earlier work that you did, that really did check on
and industries that we did, of course. We were concerned about hazards. We wanted to have a little study on women painting radio dials and clocks and that sort of thing. Lead poisoning, and the beauty shop, in a sense, started out as a hazard because somebody had written Miss Anderson from the women's groups. Right? I do think there was much more communication between women's groups and Miss Anderson than there ever was afterwards.
Mm.
She apparently was a figure to many of them that they felt that they could approach and they could write to and tell her the things that they were interested in. And if she thought it was, she would follow up on and get a little more backing. And I...
Do you think that prevailed straight through to when she retired?
When she was leaving?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think to a certain extent. Now, the telephone union, I remember the man in the telephone union saying that they wanted some facts on women, and the telephone union was quite new in those days. He said, I went to somebody and said, well, go see Mary Anderson, she'll help you. She'll get something if you know what you want. And so I think there was a strong feeling, and I think probably the unions have had more research of their own, and they had their research divisions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need to call on the government. In fact, they don't want the government anymore, I doubt. So it's just a changing world.
Mm-hmm.
We all change.
Well, looking back over those years, how do you feel about what the Bureau did? And do you think that you talked about the disillusionment of some of the people who've been with it all the time. Do you feel that it accomplish anything for women?
That, I suppose, is awfully hard to measure. Things are just part of the whole environment, aren't they? You don't know what influences you. A little thing here, a little thing there. Maybe it has an effect, you don't know. I don't think it was any catastrophic thing that they pushed, but how much they provided just the general background. Oh, she says.
But do you have a sense of that? One of the things that has impressed me and that I've discussed with Mary Hilton is that in that hiatus of the women's movement between suffrage and actually the 60s, and with a little period during after the Second World War, the Bureau seemed to be the only kind of visible women's, not just organization, but a visible voice. Women.
Well,
do you have a sense of that during that period?
I think probably I was getting out of there at that time, and I didn't know it. I said that, I've said to many of my friends, I work for the Women's Bureau, nobody's ever heard of it. I mean, that's true.
Mm.
I don't know that, I think with certain groups it, it was an impetus or it was a stimulant to certain things, but I don't think it's been any world shattering. I don't know that even the Women's Party bothered to attack it much in recent years. I think they just, and of course now they're all for the YRA.
Yeah.
And I suppose there's a change in, personally I don't,
well, I know some of the Women's Party people...
I don't know whether it'll change things or not.
Well, women who was...
It doesn't guarantee equal pay.
No.
And it's going to open up a Pandora's box of legal things.
But
I think it should pass.
Until recently, did not... I mean, obviously, the argument all these years should have been that the union should have extended what was ever good legislation to cover men and women both.
Both, yes.
And in California...
Well, they did to some extent.
Yeah, finally.
Yes.
And then in California, of course, when the state Equal Rights Amendment was passed and the ERA was ratified, the Industrial Welfare Commission did, in fact, try and eliminate some of those laws.
Yeah. But I think I remember being in California. Let's see, when did your report... it passed very early.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I asked some of the employers, and they looked at me. They didn't even know you had an equal pay law. I said, what are you talking about? Do we have an equal pay law? This was equal pay. And not equal rights, but equal pay. Well, he'd never heard of it. So I was in Maine. I tried it out again. I think I tried it out first in California. Quite a few employers. Because unless you had men and women, most of equal pay law on identical jobs, it's almost impossible to apply. And the same thing happened in Maine. I didn't try it on the little restaurant or the little laundry you wouldn't expect. But if it got to be a little bigger, the man just looked at me and laughed. He said, well, I never heard of it. So I don't know how effective it was.
Now, by the time you must
have... it was very hard to enforce equal pay law.
Yeah.
And it will be.
Well, because you have that problem, too, of how do you equate different jobs.
What is comparable
and
effort. And I remember, because I did quite a few chasing around on equal pay just for case studies in a large firm in Pittsburgh. The union had pointed out that they had equal pay there, that men's and women's jobs were evaluated on the same basis. Well, I didn't find any, women were all in the low-paid jobs anyway, and I didn't find any women with the same number of points as men had. Let's say that on the average point, the lowest points were by a point system evaluation, which I trust isn't being done much anymore, was 600 points, and your job might go up to 3,000 points.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the women were banged down here, the 6 to 1,000. But no man hardly got into those groups, so the general manager was very cooperative. We talked on. I said, I just can't understand this. Do you mind if I sit around a little more and just play with this, see if I can find out what's causing this? Because the union says you have equal pay, and you think you have. And I said, I still don't think you have. Well, he was good-natured. He said, all right. Well, what I found eventually after, I don't know how, I was probably slow on the uptake. Every man was getting 300 points because he was a man. Or so after I discovered just by, working on the working sheets where they'd evaluated the job, that if you're a male, suddenly you didn't notice it at first, that 300 points, I didn't realize it was just being a man that these 300 points went on. So I trotted up to the general manager, who I say was very good-natured, and quite research-minded, and I said, look. He said, what? And I said, yes, look. Well, he said, that's something, I'll call the boys. It was a big enough firm to have industrial engineers. He said, I'll call them in. And so he just looked at me and said, now you explain to her why you get 300 points for being a man. I suppose I get 300 points because I'm a man. Well, they didn't evaluate his job. And he said, I suppose you all got 300 points because you're a man. Just why? Well, they sat and looked at one another. They really just didn't know at first. Then one of them said, well, that's for emergencies and the men might have to do heavy work. You know, one time Pittsburgh was badly flooded. And the men had to stay all through the night swamping out the water and so on. This manager really was a lot of fun. He said, goodness, when was that? That was before I came. I've been here 10 years and we haven't had a flood. He said, you'll have to think of a better hand. He said, did the union buy that? Yes, the union bought it. I may not be right on the 300 points, but
yeah,
it was a certain number of points.
Right.
And it took me quite a while to see that this was being added on. Every job that was evaluated, men, And I got out of these jobs, and the jobs didn't say sex, it didn't say male or female. Mm-hmm. It was just an evaluation of the job. But why were all these jobs with men on way? I don't know. And maybe in an emergency they would have to. I don't know, the women would have to sweep out the water or move the stock. He said, well, that was the possibility of some emergency, a fire or a flood or some other, a bomb or something else that the men could be called on. And of course, those things exist.
Well, I think that's probably why there is still a need for the Women's Bureau, because I think those things still do happen. Unfortunately, yeah. They probably don't have the resources anymore to be doing that sort of monitoring.
They don't know that it's doing, and I know another place where men were working on things that were about this large and women were working on the small, and neither one weighed more than an ounce or a couple ounces, but they were different jobs according to the management. Well, I said, that's going to be awfully hard to prove, because if anything, it's a lot easier to work on something that size than on this size.
When was this, the 1940s equal pay?
No, but every once in a while we had a burst of running out on equal pay.
Of
incidents that were used probably in speeches, used for not even ever put into one study, but just spot things that I often did.
So it was sort of an ongoing check.
An ongoing check on somebody who'd come up and, for instance, when Miss Anderson got a call from Chicago, that was after Prohibition, that was in the 30s too, I had been a son, that all the waitresses were being laid off. If you do know Chicago, in that little sort of Lake District down where you would almost call black and tan, it's probably changed a lot below Roosevelt. And there were a few of the near north side restaurants. When they started serving liquor, they were laying all the women off and employing only men, because this was the 30s and it was a depression. And the men wanted jobs, and the restaurant union preferred the men. So with Prohibition as a background, the unions organized some of these larger restaurants, and the poor little waitresses had to go, because the union said it wasn't a fit place for them to work. They served liquor. So Miss Anderson got a call from Fitzsimmons, I think he was in Chicago at that time, the head of the Central Labor Council. Well, can you do anything for us? Send somebody out. We've got a mess here. He said, frankly, it's a mess. The women are being... Oh, the women then got together some money and went and tried to get an organization, their own little... And the union refused to give them a charter, because they were protecting the men. And it was, according to girls, a big boss in Chicago. So Miss Anderson came and called and said, well, get on the train, go out to Chicago, be there Monday morning, talk to Fitzsimmons, see if you can find out what it is, and maybe we can do something, but go out and find out. That would, a thing like that would never be written up. I'll go out and see if you can see what the situation is. And so I trotted around to the restaurants, went to see Fitzsimmons, and went out to visit a good many of the girls to find out just what had happened, and just were laid off because it was liquor. And they all, of course, told me about this tough boy from the St. Louis had come up with the bartenders and restaurant workers union. He was gonna, in fact, I went to him. No, they weren't fit places for the women. They were still working at Marshall Fields, and they were still working in the family restaurants, but these were the restaurants serving liquor. Well, long and short of it was, why we got them a charter through Fitzsimmons, an independent charter, it seems, the AFL, not a restaurant work charter, but gave them an independent charter with which the others couldn't picket. They were a member of the AFL, a special organization. Fitzsimmons in Chicago went along with that.
Huh.
And then the boys couldn't pick it and get them out. So I guess some of them at least got their jobs back. Well, I said to the man, the rest of them, if they're not fit for women work, they surely are not fit for places for women customers to be in. And questionable whether they're fit for young boys. Most of them were perfectly just ordinary restaurants. That's all they were. They had bars. Bars suddenly came into prominence.
Mm-hmm.
You hadn't had any bars for quite a few years, and it wasn't even a question of being a bartender. I know I argued with that with him. I said, eventually, no reason why a woman couldn't be a bartender, is there? Oh, well, she shouldn't handle liquor. Well, of course, all that is ridiculous, that sort of thing. And Miss Anderson, through her goodwill with the AFL, I think probably that was... we had nothing to do with it. They were the ones that issued an independent charter.
But you basically ended up acting as a mediator in the situation.
Well, at least getting the facts.
Yeah.
And I remember the girls were, some of them, I'd go and see them at night in their homes and around, said, aren't you afraid? They're an awful tough lot. And I said, oh, they probably won't pick off an old government worker. That wouldn't be worth any Well, that days they weren't doing so much of that anyway, but because you'd run around and chase them down, don't you?
Yeah.
And the employers, of course, wanted the women back. It wasn't on the face of only the, it was a union against, the Western Union against the women at that time, there was no question.
Yeah.
And the Chicago Labor Council recognized it and said, that we'll just give them an independent charter. It's an AFL charter, and they can have that little union, give us their money, whatever it was, and we'll issue a charter and a number, and they can't be picketed.
Now, to what extent did
no, I don't know.
Business and professional women also call on the Bureau? Was that much
rarer? Not for the things like office studies and, say, women in office work, and they'd be more interested in women's upper mobility.
Mm-hmm.
And then they weren't too concerned about the wage earning women.
Yeah. So it was really a different nature. The relationship was quite different than to the other women's organizations.
Well, of course, although you're an industrial woman, and when your department stores, your laundries, your restaurants, and your factory, after all, you have more women working in the mercantile and the laundries and those types of industries.
Yeah.
And they, of course, weren't the very industries that weren't very organized.
Right.
So it was just to show up wages, and those which were pretty pathetic at one time.
See, that's the other sense I have of the change in the Bureau, is that in the early, in the earlier period, and up till the war, and probably through the war study, the focus is so much more on the wage-earning women,
yes.
The industrial and the lower scale
workers,
whereas you get a shift later into
the white-collar
professionals.
Yes, I think that was very true.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I suppose part of that was the wage and hour law. Never, there was more organization, but women never got too well organized.
Yeah.
What, are they 25%? Not much more than that, are they?
No, I think it's
less than that, I think.
Yeah,
probably
it used to be. It used to be 11, I guess, back in those days.
And then it got up to one high, probably as high as 20 or something. But then it's gone down again. Organized. So it's never been very high. And you've never been able to organize the white collar worker other than the telephone worker, the telephone. The telegraphers,
mm-hmm.
and some of them were fairly well organized, but the newspaper women, but they were mostly in the bindery.
Oh, yeah.
He says the bindery work has become automatic, and much of it is not much hand work left. A lot of the women, jobs that women did do years ago were taken over by technological
yeah.
changes
yeah.
of mechanization. We of course tried to study that one time to a limited degree, but. It was a little difficult to pin it down.
I wonder what...
And we tried to make studies, I remember at one time, make studies of the factor of fatigue. That was, again, as an argument against long hours I sat with Mrs. Best at cotton mills, watching to see the ends broken down in the spinning mill. As the day went on towards 10 hours, were there more ends down at the 8th, 9th, and 10th hour than there were at the 4th, 5th, and 6th, which was much more of a technical, study who sat watched and counted and checked. Well, again, you'd have to have a controlled situation to
mm-hmm.
do it. And we tried it with chocolate dippers. Mrs. Best and I were, I used to get interested in these off things, and we were quite interested in could we prove anything that fatigue entered in the long day.
What was her name?
Fatigue.
No, what was the...
Mrs. Ethel Best, she's been dead a long time,
oh.
but she liked that sort of thing, so she and I cooked up something that we were doing another survey, but if we had a little extra time, with Miss Anderson's consent and knowledge, we were doing this as a sideline.
Oh, so some of the field workers did also, in effect, design some and initiate.
Well, this would be just a pilot. We were going to see if we found out whether it was worth going on to more extensive study. And if we were in an industry where there was a possibility of fatigue or something entered, we'd see if we could get some cooperative employers to let us spend a couple of days looking at the angle. Well, we didn't get enough. By the time we had tried it out, she and I think both had agreed that if you were going to do it, you'd have to do it under a controlled condition with people who were doing very similar things, because remember when industry found the output went up, the hours went down. It became longer. Well, it was because of the Christmas rush, and they were making money, and they were piece workers. And they just drove themselves more and more. So the longer the hours were, not only total earnings, but hourly earnings were greater under the long hours than they were under the short hours, because in the short hours they started dawdle. There wasn't going to be enough work. They didn't get paid anymore, but why knock yourself out when you weren't going to make very much? You wouldn't make any more over 6 hours or 8 hours than you would over four if you worked hard, but you might as well sit around in the factory and twiddle your thumbs and do what you felt like. But if you had a chance to make a lot of money, the Christmas season was coming up and you had to drive yourself, well, you could work 10 hours at top speed. So that was very disquieting when you found the production increase.